It's great to start with some 2 minutes of good evening, everybody. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and thank you very much, Keith. Far greater honour for me to have you here than for you to introduce myself. There's no doubt that music is the most interiorising and powerful of all the arts, since it bypasses the mind and goes straight to the heart. So I played this medieval Vespers hymn, O Lux Beata Trinitas, O Trinity of Blessed Light, Anonymous, in order to bypass the mind and open our hearts, just as Bach's cantatas were sung every week in church to prepare the congregation for the words of the sermon. So, consider yourselves prepared. I will, in fact, mainly be talking about visual art this evening when attempting to answer the question, what is sacred art and does it have a place in the world today? However, the composer John Kavanagh, who specialised in sacred music and was closely associated with the Temenos Academy. I'm sure many of you know his work. He spoke and wrote beautifully about sacred art in general. And the piece I played, in fact, is from his album Darkness into Light, which has pieces by him as well as earlier pieces like this one. You cannot talk about the sacred, he wrote, unless you also talk about God. The presence of God. The presence of the divine is the initial and ultimately unique presupposition of the sacred, because without that presence, there is no sacredness anywhere. So John Kavanagh continues by saying that the whole purpose of sacred music, and I would add all of the sacred arts, including architecture, painting, sculpture, poetry, dance, and so on, must be to lead us to the threshold of prayer, or to the threshold of a true encounter with the living God. For the sacred is prior, ontologically prior to art, and is totally unaffected by anything that art can do or cannot do. Although, of course, it does possess a, if it does possess a sacred quality, it can certainly help us to renew our awareness of the sacred. And we could say that this is the primary purpose of all art, that aspires to manifest in some form or another, and there are a multiplicity of forms, a sacred or transcendent reality. He continues, an icon, for instance, is not art, it is beyond art. because it is a real presence that we venerate, a still, almost silent presence looking tenderly at us, helping us to pray, and lifting our minds and hearts above this earth, where we are in exile for a short time, into heaven, our true homeland. And although this icon here is only a slide, I think one may be able to discern something of that still presence that Taverner is referring to. A presence that many of us like to bring to our own places of prayer or meditation to help us detach from our anxieties and find our still center, renew our awareness of the sacred that's so vital in this increasingly demented world in which we inhabit. This presence, this stillness, may be perceived in masterpieces of art across the world from different traditions, all being sublime expressions of the sacred. For example, this Buddha from Sri Lanka. In fact, what Taverner is saying here, that the sacred is unaffected by anything art can do, accords with my revered teacher and a teacher to many of us here, Dr. Keith Critchlow, who kindly introduced me. Master geometer himself, architect and artist, and he has always preferred to say art of the sacred rather than sacred art, since the art itself is the vehicle, the formal vessel for that which is beyond art. It is the bringing into form of that which lies beyond form. Indeed, perhaps one could say that all the great religions or traditions are the different expressions of the bringing into form of the one underlying religion, the perennial philosophy, that universal and timeless beating heart of all that is considered sacred. Before we continue, we should perhaps look at the term sacred and art a little more clearly. From the definitions of the word art in the dictionary, now many of you will have looked at these yourselves, but I'll sum up as briefly. From these definitions, two principal points emerge. The first is that art is about making and demands both skill and knowledge on the part of the practitioner. And the second is the idea that the so-called fine arts, mainly painting and sculpture, a typical example of what was considered a fine art in the 19th century. They are separated from and are superior to the traditional arts and crafts, which have a practical function in daily life, such as being vessels for eating and drinking. Now, due to ignorance about the true value and meaning of traditional art, these items are looked down upon. They're considered to embody nothing more than their practical use. Whereas, in fact, this could not be further from the truth, as we shall see as we go on. This second point, the distinction between fine art and craft, is a modern one, dating from the late 18th, early 19th century. But of course its roots go right back to the Renaissance, with the beginning of a human-centered world instead of the medieval God-centered world. And perhaps one could say that this distinction is a reflection of the mainly secular world in which we live here in the West. That is, the fine arts have taken the place of the formerly highest place sacred art. Today, the fine arts are considered to have the greatest intellectual content, and that's intellect in the modern sense of the word, meaning clever, rational, and discursive. But traditionally, the intellect was centered in the heart, and was considered to be the highest faculty, higher than reason, because it was the one through which we may truly perceive the sacred. Today, the fine arts have by and large, but not entirely, embraced conceptual art. It's the only slide of conceptual art, just so that you know. And this is taught in art schools to the detriment of both the art and the students. It's the idea or the concept now, by and large, replaces the qualities central to our first point. That is that art is about making, and making it well, with painstakingly earned expertise, and over many years, and these made from carefully selected and appropriate materials. Interesting, recently I was told a story about art students who went on strike at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. This only was a couple of years ago. They were demanding to be taught, shock, horror, a skill. And in fact, one of my students recently, I think, was at Chelsea. A similar thing happened there. And this bucket, or milk pail, as it's correctly called, I think, is... this is placed in a rather well-known, smart, newish art gallery in Somerset. And I think it costs about £100,000 or £150,000. The good people of Bruton, where this is, in this village, they put a bucket in a window of a hardware store with a mop in it and said, £150,000 with a slash through it, yours for only £15. I'm not sure how well it went down. So today, it seems that in general, and I'm talking in general terms, as I know there are very, very fine true artists and craftsmen here tonight, we've not only largely lost or forgotten the craft of art, the actual making, but also perhaps the purpose and the meaning. In an age where formal religion has declined so drastically, and I'm referring mainly to Christianity here, since here in the UK we are from a long history and culture, mainly a still Christian country. But many people go to museums and galleries on a Sunday in search of something intellectually stimulating, perhaps intellectually in both senses of the word. Perhaps they are hoping to find works that may provoke serious existential discussion, deeper than aesthetics and technique, works with content that perhaps tell a story and may move them towards contemplation of what it means to be human. Formerly in the Middle Ages, in the West, and in traditional societies which are centered upon the sacred, all art to a greater or lesser degree was made with love and care from natural materials, was well informed and integrated into daily living. Its beauty was both a subtle teaching and a reflection of the divinity which penetrated the whole of life. This is true traditional art, as I referred to earlier. Beauty, as Ananda Kumaraswamy wrote, one of the greatest writers on sacred and traditional art of the 20th century, beauty is about cognition, and the appeal to beauty is not merely to the senses, but through the senses to the intellect. And of course he's talking about the highest intellect, centered on the heart. And Kumaraswamy also refers to Dante, who described his Divine Comedy as having a practical purpose, exhorting us to marvel at the teaching that conceals itself beneath the veil of the strange verses. So it's clear that the kind of art that we're speaking about here was neither an individualistic, subjective experiment, nor was it luxury for the wealthy elite, and there was certainly no place for the concept of art for art's sake. It was art for God's sake. Perhaps you know the rhyme, which in fact is on Keith's film about sharks. First there was art for God's sake, then art for man's sake, then art for art's sake, finally, no art for God's sake. It's no accident that the traditional artist or craftsman was by and large anonymous, like the composer of the piece that we heard at the beginning, since his role, his or her role, was to make art that was fundamentally about something larger than his or her own self. Echoing Rumi, who wrote, "I am the flute lord and thine is the music." Indeed, one of the best books today about traditional arts and crafts, which I'm constantly recommending to our students, is called The Unknown Craftsman. An artist or craftsman of this kind of art needed and still needs to prepare him or herself carefully before embarking on their work, through submission of the ego, through prayer, meditation, perhaps fasting, emptying themselves both physically and mentally for God's sake, Vacare Deo. Such practices alter both the soul and the body, so the physical vessel becomes pure enough to allow grace to enter. This is partly why the tools of such an artist are so precious, since they become, as it were, an extension of the maker themselves. They are the focus of the balance between the head, the heart, and the hand, the channel not only for the artist's skill, but also his very being, purified to receive visionary grace from above. Thus, making sacred art, and to a lesser extent traditional art, is an alchemical process, demanding the integration of body, soul, and spirit. And however hard some may argue, modern technology, such as a computer, is woefully lacking in the practice of such art, since it breaks this mysterious alchemical process. This was really brought home to me recently when trying out a form of classical Indian temple dance called Orissi. Even with simple movements, there was no question of it being just the body, since, to put it very simply, it was all about centeredness, and concentration was key. It was key between the head, the heart, and the whole body to retaining a firm center while attempting movements with various parts of the body. It was extremely challenging, and I didn't look anything like this lovely lady here. It was similar to the action of drawing a pattern in which we always start with the point of the compasses in the center, such as like the purgatory we saw a few slides earlier. Both the dancing and the drawing may help us to find our own center and thereby reconnect with our true inner self, rather than identify with the constant stream of thoughts and the alluring entrapments of the ego. So not only observing sacred art, but also, and more importantly perhaps, actually participating in it and doing it may be a transformative process if we are open to it. Such art is a true window onto heaven. And as the great 20th century authority on sacred art, Titus Burckhardt, writes, it sets up against the sermon which insists on what must be done by one who would become holy, a vision of the cosmos which is holy through its beauty. And traditional art radiates something of this holiness into the world in an indirect and sometimes intimate manner through, for example, sitting on a beautiful woven Eastern carpet. But to be more rigorous, let's ask the question, how does sacred art actually do this? How does it bring the presence of the celestial into the material, the supraformal into form? We all recognize its most magnificent examples. For example, this is the Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque in Isfahan. So the brief answer is through upholding three main principles outlined by another very great writer of the 20th century, Christoph Schoen, in his brilliant essay, The Principles and Criteria of Art. First, content. The subject of the artwork itself must be sacred, following, as he says, a canonical model, such as, for example, the slides I showed earlier of the Virgin Mary, the statue of Buddha, and Shiva here. Second, through the style, or outward form, that is the hieratic discipline and canons of a tradition. And third, through the symbolic language inherent within form. For example, a statue of Christ or Buddha or Shiva may make certain gestures and not others. They all have a significance which has a specific meaning and are never random. Now this word form needs looking at. By form we are referring to the outer shape of a work of art, the visible aspect of a thing, not to be confused with the idea form, eidos, of Plato, which corresponds to the invisible world of heavenly archetypes. Form is closely related to the third principle, symbolism, since, as Burckhardt writes, When historians of art apply the term sacred art to any and every work that has a religious subject, they are forgetting that art is essentially form. And art cannot properly be called sacred solely on the grounds that its subjects originate in a spiritual truth. Its formal language also must bear witness to a similar origin. And this is not the case, for example, some of Renaissance and most of Baroque religious art, and indeed religious artists centuries later, whose subjects, like this one, the Transfiguration, may be religious, but whose form or style is no different from the non-religious, the profane art of the period. This style reflects fundamentally a human-centered outlook, the human-centered outlook of the Renaissance and later. Martin Ling saying that humanism is a revolt of reason against the intellect. And such art has lost the largely medieval outlook wherein the spirit was foremost. So the form itself must reflect the spiritual vision of a particular religion, since there is a rigorous analogy between form and spirit. So what does this mean exactly? This analogy between form and spirit. Now this is almost 200 years earlier than the Raphael. This is Simone Martini's Annunciation. So compare the Raphael, shown just before, with this Annunciation, where sacred canons of representation have been followed, giving the subject, through an almost flat two-dimensional perspective, a certain abstract formality and dignity. It is not a painting of a religious subject in human form, in the style of the Raphael, that we've just seen, but rather a transcendent vision of the artist given form by a certain rules of style handed down from master to apprentice over generations, authentic tradition in fact. The artist is guided by his inner eye, which is worth, as Plato wrote, 10,000 other eyes. The image succeeds in depicting something of the true holiness and heavenly grace of the Annunciation, radiating divinity and a powerful sense of the sacred. Whereas the later painting, the Raphael, impresses us with the artist's skill in his depiction of the human body, but in doing so loses something of the divine mystery. Therefore, through a radical change in the formal style, a whole alteration in perspective is apparent. Tradition safeguards the sacred, if you like, protecting against the possible interference of the artist's ego and desire to innovate. As it says in the Tao Te Ching, "Woe to him who willfully innovates while ignorant of the constant." And interestingly, this also echoes the Upanishads, which in the description of the fire sacrifice, an important Vedic ritual, still widely performed in India today, it's written that one is not granted the freedom to do it in any manner one likes, because the aim is to discipline one's mind and to develop one's willpower, and not to be guided by one's whims, caprices, and moods. This is important and a challenge for most of us, but particularly so if practicing an art of the sacred. Formal supra-individual expression in Islamic art is achieved through the skillful employment of three main objective elements: calligraphy, geometry, and arabesque or islimi. There's a fundamental and serene order transmitted via these means through the clear, sensitive, and knowledgeable application of proportion, harmony, balance, rhythm, and color. A beauty of calm repose is conveyed, reflecting the unity of spirit that is fundamental to the civilization of Islam. This is the Ibn Tulun Mosque in Cairo. Now, the individualistic age in which we live means that order and discipline in art are not very fashionable, and I'm all too aware that, present company excluded, most art students do not agree with what they may seem to be, with what may seem to be a too rigid definition of form in sacred art. This is definitely the issue which brings up the most questions. In my own seminars on sacred and traditional art at the Prince's School, a few students will say, but I find this more sacred, this more moving than the other, referring to, say, a Raphael or Michelangelo, or closer to our own era, the abstract expressionist Mark Rothko. He is a 20th century favourite that many art lovers find deeply moving and spiritual. Perhaps they see in his painting something of what David Hockney said. Painters such as Vasily Kandinsky and Mark Rothko thought that colours and shapes were more real than pictures of people or trees, or rather that they depicted an inner reality or truth as distinct from appearances. This is really crucial to all sacred art, the idea of the veiling of the absolute by the relative. So to return to symbolism, the third of the three principles, this is the entrance to the main Friday mosque in Yazd in Isfahan. As Peter Burkhardt wrote, and I mentioned before, there's a rigorous analogy between form and spirit. And the language of this analogy is symbolism. It is not one-dimensional signs we are referring to here, such as a lion symbolizing royalty or a swan symbolizing dignity, but rather the many-layered timeless symbols which lead us from the here and now back to the eternal archetype, the great primordial symbols that we always refer to, the circle and the square, which in all their infinite manifestations from a Byzantine church in Italy, in Florence, to the domes of mosques in Cairo, for example, and a geometric ceiling in the Alhambra, the octagon transitioning between the square below and the circle above. Always these are echoes of the celestial canopy hovering over the square of the earth. And Burkhardt writes, in fact, that all sacred architecture is the transformation of the circle into the square. Etymologically, symbol comes from the Greek meaning to throw together, as opposed to diabol, to throw apart, from which, of course, we have diabolic. Thus, in relation to sacred art, the symbolic form is a bringing or throwing together of earth and heaven, symbol and archetype. In the Quran, it is many times mentioned that everything in creation is a symbol or mirror of the higher eternal world. This brings us on to what may well be considered the greatest sacred art, Virgin Nature, which Dr. Quitchley referred to in his introduction. The whole of nature being a symbol because she is the pure and untouched divine creation and is open to all regardless of background or creed. As Mark Perry writes, nature is the first and last revelation because it is the scripture of the eternal. The trace of his hand is found in every rippling field of grass or fluttering leaf or silent flower. To read them is to help recover our roots of immortality. The question here is, as with human-made sacred art, who still knows how to read them, to read these signs? For Native Americans, nature was and is their religion, and reading nature is a way of life. In fact, it may be that today more people read nature as a book of sacred knowledge than we imagine. Since tradition here in the West has by and large disintegrated, it is often through contemplating the majesty and beauty of landscapes and nature that provides the clearest path to recovering our roots of immortality. It is all too easy to love the beauty and magic of the natural world and want to protect it, as the environmentalists and indeed most of us would like to do. But in doing so, we often forget who the ultimate sustainer of this world is. As Plato writes, and the Quran also, we need to constantly remind ourselves of the divine unity underlying nature and the infinite variety of this manifest world. Through immersing ourselves in nature, we hope to understand what the Persian poet Sa'di wrote. To the eye of a discerning man, every leaf upon a growing tree is a book imparting knowledge of our Creator. In my own particular field, the gardens in Islam, there's no doubt that the art of the Islamic garden, based as it is on a heavenly archetype described in the Quran, provides a powerful opportunity for renewing a sense of the sacred and remembering what it means to be human. Such an artist was Samuel Palmer, about whom Brian Keeble, who Dr. Critchlow mentioned in his introduction, was a co-founder of Temenos. And he's written a wonderful essay about Palmer, describing how in his so-called Shoreham years, when he was only in his early 20s, Palmer did not copy what he observed with his outward eye, but was guided by deep contemplation, piercing the veil of outward phenomena to give a taste of nature's inner mystery. There are others who also became absorbed in nature's transcendent beauty as a vehicle for expressing a sense of the divine, even if they did not put it like that. This is Henri Rousseau. There's also Claude Monet and Paul Gauguin. This is Gauguin, Sacred Spring. All of them, you could say, have been attempting to depict paradise through their own inward vision. Such art does not follow all the principles I've talked about, so can it be considered sacred art? The subject or content is sacred, its nature, but the form is very much their own. One could say there is a profound symbolism in that the artist in each case, in attempting to represent in abstracted form the truth hidden behind outward appearances, what the inner eye has perceived, absorbed, and transformed. Now, if we agree with what I quoted from Titus Burkhard earlier, that art cannot properly be called sacred solely on the grounds that its subjects originate in a spiritual truth, its formal language also must bear witness to a similar origin. Now, if we agree with that, then perhaps there is no discussion. These paintings I've just shown, this one and the two before, they are not considered. They would not be considered sacred art. I would say this is an ongoing discussion. I'm leaving the question open, and perhaps people will want to add something at the end. There's no doubt that the work of the three artists I've selected give art lovers greater reward than just aesthetic pleasure. For many, they open our own inner eye and perhaps move the heart and soul to awaken a spiritual yearning and that symbolic consciousness that used to be our natural state. So this leads us on to the question, is there a place for sacred art in the world today? See, from the hordes of visitors to the Monet exhibition last year in London, perhaps some of you went to it, it seems that there is indeed a very important place for such art, which may not, strictly speaking, according to our principles, be considered sacred, but which nevertheless transmits qualities of beauty and nobility. And these are needed more than ever before in our world of ever-expanding urban sprawl and ugliness. I'm fortunate enough to have visited the Alhambra and the Generalife in Granada many times, often on field trips with our students from the Prince's School. It is one of the most visited sites in Europe. Over 6,000 people per day And it's worth asking the question, why do so many people flock here? What is it about these buildings and gardens that draws them? They come for the exquisite and intimate beauty of the palaces and gardens, yes. But is there not something more within this spectacle that moves them? I was there several times with Dr. Critchlow, I'm very happy to say, and I remember him observing that most visitors seem to walk around in a state of bewilderment. Outwardly, the Alhambra is a series of palaces designed 13th to 14th centuries for the Nasrid sultans and their families, as well as a show for petitioners and other rulers. But the extraordinary harmony and ambiance of peace and stillness that penetrates the whole, in spite of the crowds, incredibly in spite of the crowds, speaks of something deeper. The outer beauty reflects an underlying unity of vision and way of life steeped in the divine mystery. And there's no doubt that even the bewildered have an inkling of this. Thus they keep on coming, their hearts open, a sense of calm and centeredness descending, even if only temporarily. This is in the Henralife, the Sultana Garden. Now, tourism is enormous business today. It developed from the Grand Tour in the 18th century, which affluent young men were sent on in order to broaden their knowledge of European culture. In fact, interestingly, Thomas Cook, everyone's heard of Thomas Cook, the travel agent, but he started out, he was a Baptist preacher, and one of the first things he did at the beginning was to take people on pilgrimages to Palestine. So what is tourism? We could say, if not a disguised pilgrimage, a journey to the heart, if the traveller only knew. So like tourists who traipse around the Alhambra, vast numbers also visit the Taj Mahal. Again, why do they go? Outwardly, the Taj Mahal was built by Shah Jahan for love of his wife, who died in childbirth. Everyone knows the story. But it is, of course, far more than that. Its beauty speaks of a truly celestial monument to divine love, fulfilling all of our principles to a supreme degree, and it, so that it seems as though it has dropped directly from heaven. Thus, even if people have little knowledge of sacred art or even an awareness of the sacred, such monuments are still vitally important today. Indeed, even more so, it could well be argued. They have the potential to open up the hearts of the more sensitive and discerning, helping to lead them back, for however short a time, to a state of serenity and recollectedness. What we also need more than ever, as Kumaraswamy argues in his marvellous essay, written in the 1950s, Why Exhibit Works of Art, what we need, he says, is a docent. Most people haven't heard of the word docent. It's an old-fashioned term for a good guide, a useful word. This is someone who is not afraid to explain that such works of art are about God, a word, he says, not mentioned in polite society anymore. This is Mont Saint-Michel in northern France. It's also interesting to note that the number of pilgrims walking the Camino, the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela, has increased year on year from 1,000 in 1986. To 260,000 in 2015. And today, the number visiting Mont Saint-Michel has reached 3 million visitors a year. Such great examples of sacred art and architecture as the three we've just looked at, the Alhambra, the Taj Mahal, and Mont Saint-Michel, and the number of visitors they attract each year is testimony to the great need for such centres of beauty and holiness. Today, more than ever, people struggle to live a sane and contented life, to say the least. The statistics for those on antidepressants in the UK are deeply alarming, not to mention drugs and alcoholism. And the issue of mental health looms ever larger, while healthcare systems struggle to cope or governments fail to care. As many have suggested, this may well be due to a loss of the spiritual dimension in our lives. Materialism and consumerism having swamped us to an unprecedented degree. And many of us spend a lot of time planning how to find unspoiled places in the countryside, in nature, to get away from it all. And as Keith mentioned some time ago, they rarely put modern buildings or commercial centres on adverts for travel abroad. It's more often than not, it's a picture of a beautiful building, which is also more often than not, it's a sacred building. What they are looking for, to slightly paraphrase, the writer, farmer and pioneer environmentalist Lord Northbourne, what they are looking for, did they but know it, is not so much natural beauty, but communion with God. It is that too that the lover of flowers and nature is really seeking. So more than ever is the art of the sacred important today, I would say. And this is not only for the art lover, but even more the artists and craftsmen themselves. My experience of teaching for nearly 25 years in an art school has demonstrated how frustrated and lost students feel when they attend an art school which no longer teaches techniques and skills, let alone meaning in art. The few who come to us at the Prince's School generally breathe a sigh of relief because at last not only are they taught skills and techniques, but also that art has a meaning and it's allowed to be beautiful. Plotinus wrote that one should not go to the images of beauty, but to beauty itself. But how is this possible? Dr. Critchlow said, it is the intention of aiming for it, the act of aspiring towards it, if you like, that brings about the beautiful. If this is a sincere aim and one is an empty vessel, then inspiration or grace will descend. So with an open heart and a certain humility, just as the material on which the artist is working is transformed into something beautiful, so may the soul also be transformed. The alchemical process we referred to earlier is really about knowing oneself, one's true self, not the worldly self that we are all too often caught up in. Dr. Critchlow has also written that sacred geometry is active prayer, and thus what is key in keeping alive sacred art is action or practice. Just as prayer requires renewal several times a day in order to keep the presence of the sacred alive constantly, so art requires a dialogue between the artist and his or her materials, honouring the subject matter, the tools, the materials, as well as the initial intention. Not to mention the viewer, who is offered the opportunity to taste the sacred realities that the resulting work may impart by the grace of heaven. I watched in this idea of keeping it alive, active prayer, I watched an interesting documentary last year about the convent of San Marco in Florence, where Fra Angelico painted some of his famous, beautiful sacred images. In each of the former cells was one of his exquisite frescoes, no longer, as it were, kept alive by the praying and meditating monks. However, the images are still a silent and still presence, and perhaps welcome the visits from the serious tourist, the pilgrim, who may benefit from such serene and moving works of art and come away with a renewed inspiration themselves for contemplation and prayer. So I would say there is no question there is a place for the arts of the sacred today. On the level of individual opinion, what we all consider to be sacred may vary, but on the higher level of the impersonal, or rather suprapersonal, the principles we looked at may act as an objective guide for discernment, helping us to understand that true sacred art transcends subjective taste through conforming to guidelines handed down and authenticated by tradition. Importantly, true sacred art may help us to know ourselves on a deeper level, to help us understand what it means to be human, and remind us, as Hamlet says, that there is a divinity which shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will. Thank you.